From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Corporations in the U.S. have never been happier. They have friends in high places, in the White House, in Congress, the Treasury, the Justice Department, all of which have helped to ensure the U.S. economy is more and more dominated by corporate monopolies. We turn now to David Dayan, the executive editor of The American Prospect, whose work has appeared in The Intercept, The New Republic, Huffington Post, The Washington Post, The LA Times, and more. His first book, Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud, won the Studs and Ida Terkel Prize. And he now joins me to discuss his newest book called Monopolized, Life in the Age of Corporate Power. He's a frequent guest on our program. Welcome back, David.
Thank you very much, Sonali.
So I love how you start with the first chapter of your book explaining to readers that monopolies are the reason why people keep getting deep vein thrombosis on long-haul flights. We live in a country where fewer and fewer corporations control whole industries. How is it that this is the state of the country today, given that we're supposed to have things like antitrust laws in place? This has been a problem historically in our country, and government has addressed it in the past, and we seem to have come right back to where corporate monopolies are becoming more common.
Yeah, I mean, you know, competition is supposed to be this great conservative value, right? That the free market has a bunch of competitors in it, and you get to pick and choose what is best for you, and people rise and fall on the strength of the quality of the product that they provide. And that's just not true anymore. I mean, sometime around the 1980s, the government basically gave up on antitrust policy. And as a result, we have the situation that we're living through today, where a handful of companies control more and more sectors of the economy. And of course, one of the things that results from that is that quality suffers. So why should a monopolist give you a good product if you have nowhere else to go to get that product? And a perfect example of that is the airlines. So, anyone that's traveled over the last several years knows that it's an increasingly miserable experience where you're packed in like sardines into a smaller and smaller space. The situation with deep vein thrombosis is the fact that more people, when they're shoved into a very small legroom on a long haul flight of over 4 or 5 hours, they get blood clots in their legs. This is kind of a common thing. It's known as economy class syndrome. It's seen as something that's very endemic to long haul flights. And there have been activist groups that have tried to get the Federal Aviation Administration to change the rules and put some minimum requirements in for seat pitch, which is that's the technical term for how far your seat is from the person in front of you. And the airlines have been able to stop this over and over. And it's really a few airlines, four airlines control 80% of all the routes domestically in the United States. And they have just fought this over and over again because, of course, every inch that they take away from your legroom, they get to put another row with more paying customers in the back of the plane. And of course, in the pandemic, what we're seeing now is they're selling the middle seats in many of these large airlines, even though you're supposed to have social distancing. And, obviously, if you're packed, shoulder to shoulder with somebody, you're not distanced nearly enough from them. So this is a function of power that is in the hands of just a few airlines. And really, for your personal airline to get where you want to go, in most cases, you have one choice. And when you have one choice, quality suffers.
Right. And the airline industry, you're right, is one of many, many industries in the country that are increasingly basically able to set their own rules because there's fewer and fewer of them. And also, there are other industries where if you scratch the surface, you find monopolies where you didn't realize there were. Let's talk about the food industry. You talk about going into supermarkets and seeing shelves of what appear to be a huge variety of products, but in reality, there's actually not that many companies that control our food system. So give us a sense of how bad the food system's monopoly is and what the direct impact is on our food.
Yeah, I mean, this is sort of from beginning to end, right? So you could start at the farm, and everything on the farm is part of a very concentrated industry. Whether you're talking about meat and meat packing companies, which are very, very narrowed, two or three companies control most of beef and pork and chicken and dairy products. Also, in terms of produce. There are very few companies that sell you the seeds, and you have to buy them every year. As you know, Monsanto has a patent on seeds, and you can't use them more than 1 year at a time. And so this affects the farmer's ability to eke out a living. The very large factory farms, the concentrated animal feeding operations, or CAFOs, create major environmental hazards wherever they go for refuse. One of the big places for CAFOs is hog farms in North Carolina. And of course, North Carolina is a magnet for hurricanes. And you have these lagoons where the waste product for hogs goes, and it just runs off during a hurricane and contaminates entire areas of North Carolina. If you're living near one of those facilities, and disproportionately you have Black and Latino people living in and around those facilities, your life is miserable. You know, the smell just stays with you, kind of, it's ever present in your life. So that's, sort of, in terms of the raw product. And then when it gets to your table and gets to your grocery store, you think there are all these different distributors of different kinds of peanut butter, jelly, or whatever. But it's usually just sort of dressed up as a different label made by the same company. So there are, mainly two or three companies that make all the peanut butter, and two or three companies that make all the toothpaste in the country. So that affects, choice. It affects innovation in terms of if somebody has a better idea, it's harder for them to get shelf space in your grocery store and get to market. It has an effect on sort of the flourishing of diversity in our lives and in our food. I think that this is the food sector is one of the prime examples of a monopolized industry.
And the industry knows that if they create many varieties of the same thing, they can take up shelf space, which of course means more eyeballs on their products, etc. Let's talk about a topic close to your and my heart, journalism. Monopolies, you write, are why hundreds of journalists became filmmakers, then back to writers, then unemployed. I remember the great writer Ben Bagdikian with his book Media about Media Monopolies years ago, warning that a smaller and smaller number of corporations owned media outlets. So how badly is journalism impacted by corporate monopoly?
It's getting really bad, and it's made worse by the fact that so much of the funding and the revenue source for journalism comes from digital advertising, and that is dominated by Google and Facebook. And those two companies, which control 80 or 90% of new advertising on the internet, deprive an outlet of having this audience that they built through their talent and being able to monetize it in any way. It makes it impossible to sell advertising through one of your firms. So there was a study recently from the University of North Carolina that shows that 1,800 papers, newspapers, have closed over the last several years, and there are now 1,300 communities in the United States that have no daily news outlet. So these are deserts, and it's interesting. You know, I wrote the book about a year ago, but one of the things I mentioned, and this was before COVID-19 was a thing, was that news deserts actually help cause and further pandemics, because epidemiologists rely on news sources to figure out and track where viruses are moving in throughout a particular region. And so, you know, cutting off with news deserts actually has probably made it harder for people to track the pandemic, in particularly in rural communities. So that was the problem. The thing I was talking about in that particular headline is this thing that was called the pivot to video. And the pivot to video was that Facebook decided about 4 or 5 years ago that everything they wanted to do was going to be in video. And if you were a news outlet or a publisher that really wanted to capture the attention of folks, you had to get to video in order to find your people on Facebook. And of course, everyone congregates to Facebook. And so you have to sort of follow their rules, whatever rules they decide to make up. So tons of digital media outlets decided to become film studios, essentially. They scrapped a lot of their news staffs, their writing staffs. They told people to make short videos instead, and they pivoted like this. And then it was revealed that Facebook was essentially lying to advertisers about how many people were watching videos on Facebook, and didn't disclose that to them for about a year. And after that, Facebook said, oh, well, so much for the pivot to video, we're pivoting back. And so all of these publishers that changed their entire business model to move to video were suddenly stuck. They were completely out of luck. And a lot of them went under. And I've talked to journalists who were fired from these various companies that pivoted and then had nowhere else to go. So this shows you, and a lot of the book shows you this, the control that monopolies have, that they can make up their own laws, their own rules, and have everybody else within a market have to follow those rules. You know, when we talk a lot about deregulation, and there really is kind of no such thing as deregulation. There's regulation that's done in a public way by democratically elected officials and regulators. And then there's private regulation that is done in corporate boardrooms for the interest of those corporations. And that's
no one ever talks about that.
No one ever talks about that. And that's what we have now. We have regulation by and for corporations. And that's the effect of deregulation. So the choice is whether you want us to make rules for economies and markets and people and society in the public interest or in the private interest of corporations.
Let's talk about banks and banking, something that you have studied for a long time and that is a big part of your book. You talk about how the banking monopoly is the big reason why there are monopolies among every other economic sector. What do you mean by that?
Well, banks play a key role in mergers and acquisitions, which it's known as M&A on Wall Street. And these M&A bankers advise companies and tell them if and when to buy other companies. And their income, of course, is derived from whether or not they're successful in getting these companies to buy other companies. And so you have this very large and powerful sector on Wall Street that is completely self-interested in consolidating the economy and concentrating various markets. And that's, you know, how it goes about. They fight with each other to get a certain amount of market share in advising companies. And there's, I mean, just think about it. If a bank is advising you on mergers and acquisitions, are they going to tell you, no, don't buy that company, don't merge with that company, don't acquire that other company? That would literally be cutting off their supply of money, right? So, having this M&A be, and M&A has become a bigger part of bank balance sheets, of their profit centers, having that take place is a spur to more monopolies. And what we've seen is that merger activity in the last 5 years is at almost a peak level historically. My fear is after the pandemic, you're going to have a lot of small, sick companies or bankrupt companies that'll get scooped up by the remaining survivors, and we'll see an acceleration of this trend.
So when we have this sort of monopoly, really stifling the economy, because that's essentially what it's doing, and there's something that those, the backers of corporate power never want to admit, as you said, that this is in fact stifling the economy, that there are regulations, ones set by corporations themselves in order to maximize their profits. This seems to me the beginning of a downward spiral for this great American economy, and the U.S. has prided itself for years on innovation and leading the world in technological and other innovations. It seems as though this ultimately puts the corporate profits of these monopolies over not just consumers, but even just the actual industry itself that's in question.
It does absolutely hurt innovation, and it hurts startup activity. It hurts the ability for the business of America to thrive. Mm-hmm. Startup activity has absolutely cratered in the last 40 years. New business formation is way, way down. There are entire sectors like technology where your only chance, if you have a good idea, is to put it out there and hope that one of the big major tech firms buys you. They call it the kill zone. There's a zone where if you are a young business starting up, your only hope is to get bought, because if not, you're going to get crushed. And we see this with Facebook buying up Instagram and buying WhatsApp, and then trying to buy and being unsuccessful in buying Snapchat, but then making their own version of Snapchat that lives on Facebook to crush them. So this is the kill zone, and it's a real problem for a couple of reasons. Number one, quality. One of the chapters is about Chattanooga, Tennessee, which has municipal broadband. It's the fastest broadband in the world. It's about a 10 gigabyte broadband service that they deliver through their public utility, the electric utility. It's a fiber optic cable, and it's a fabulous service. But the telecom industry made a law in the state of Tennessee that no municipal broadband can go past the service area of that utility. And so you go 3 minutes outside of Chattanooga and they only have dial-up, and parents send their kids to Starbucks parking lots to catch the Wi-Fi so they can do their homework. So we could have nice things, right? We could have that municipal broadband, super fast internet all over the world. They can do it in Chattanooga, Tennessee. They can do it all over the country. But the reason we don't is monopoly power from the concentrated telecom sector. This also is a regional issue for inequality. All these areas in the Midwest and the Plain States that are struggling, a big cause of that is this sort of winner-take-all economic system that we have, where the big companies are located on the coast, and there are mostly chains in these areas. The small businesses have gone away, and the wealth of these regions and these communities get sucked up into these monopolists and pushed out to corporate treasuries. And so we don't have the money staying in the economy where it belongs. And, that has depressed these areas. It's led to, I'm sure you know the book Deaths of Despair, mm-hmm. by Deaton and Case. It's led to a lot of desperation. And this is a monopoly problem as much as it is everything else. So I think you're absolutely right in terms of how monopolies actually harm economies. They make them less vibrant. They make them more scattershot, where parts of the country are left behind, and it's a serious problem.
The issue of broadband, just to pick up on what you were saying earlier, of course, becomes even more important during this pandemic when so many people have had to transition to being at home, children being online at school, and when you have just one company, if you're lucky, that delivers service in your area, you have to take what they give you and shut up, and you can't really argue or shop around. No conversation around monopolies would be complete without discussing Amazon, also a company that has taken advantage of the fact that we're in a pandemic. What better business model than having delivery straight to your doorstep while you're trying to avoid crowds? Amazon has minted money during this pandemic. How seriously has its monopoly power grown? Not just since the pandemic, because of course you said you wrote the book last year, but in general, it has sort of almost epitomized this idea of a monopoly corporation.
Yeah, I mean, Amazon is a phenomenon. About half of all e-commerce searches start at Amazon.
Wow.
And as e-commerce grows, obviously Amazon's going to get more powerful. Because of that position, if you are someone who wants to sell goods, you're inevitably going to open up a store on Amazon. Because if you don't, you're not going to find anybody. That's where the eyeballs are. So that really traps these what are called third-party sellers into Amazon's marketplace, and Amazon really creates its own almost private law, this private government, the terms by which it gives to these third-party sellers, where it gets involved in their transactions. It takes a large cut out of everything that's being sold. It sets up the logistics network for how things are sold and moved across. It commingles your inventory with other people's inventory if it's the same product, and if their product is defective and it's sent out even though it was your order, it wasn't your product, but if it's defective, you get called out for it because they have a very customer-centric kind of quality to them. So you could get your account suspended because Amazon sent somebody else's product to your customer, and there are. Amazon's marketplace is weirdly almost anarchic in terms of all of the sabotage that goes on among sellers between one another, fake reviews, counterfeit goods. You'll have individuals blow up their rival's product and take pictures of it and put it on the internet.
Wow.
To try to that their rivals are not delivering a good product. And Amazon, even though it's their marketplace, they kind of have a hands-off policy with all of this. And all they do is they step in at the end and they suspend you. And if you're suspended, it's very hard to get out. There's a whole network that is built up of these consultants that try to help people get out of Amazon jail, essentially. And there are all these really Byzantine layers of who you have to contact and who you have to call. And at the end of that chain, literally, they call it a Jeff letter, and you have to send an email to Jeff Bezos. So the richest man in the world, you have to send an email to him.
Wow.
In order to try to get your account as a third-party seller just trying to scrape by and selling random goods on Amazon. That's what you have to do to get out of jail. So it's a kind of a dehumanizing environment. It subjects people to the sort of whims of this large corporation, and it's a loss of control, as I said before. And there's this sort of palpable fear around it. And that's just the third-party sellers. There are all sorts of other things going on with Amazon and how they use their power, and a lot of that is in the book. But I thought that focusing on the sellers in this marketplace was a good way to show you the impacts of monopoly.
Well, there's so much more to talk about. People certainly can pick up your book and read all the details of the monopolies you discuss. But let's wrap up our conversation with a look at what needs to happen in order to start breaking up these monopolies. Clearly, corporations, when given the chance, will form monopolies. you have to have government regulation, you have to have antitrust laws actually being enforced, or maybe new and better laws being written. What needs to happen in order to really start to address this thing that even from a capitalist perspective is stifling the things that they love to boast about capitalism providing, such as innovation, lower prices, competition, etc.
Right. And abundance. Yeah. I mean, you know, look at us in the pandemic, where they say that we're this abundant society, and we have a shortage of face masks, right? Like a piece of cloth with two strings tied around it. We don't have the capability to deliver to everyone who needs one. And that's a function of monopolies and middlemen and the fact that supply chains are concentrated in one part of the world, namely China and Taiwan. So what do we do about this? Well, I mean, we know what to do about this. We created laws in 1890 that speak to this. The Sherman Antitrust Act was 130 years ago. The Clayton Antitrust Act was over 100 years ago. Other anti-monopoly laws, like regulating chain stores and allowing for public options like a public bank or a public Wi-Fi system, like a community broadband system, are all out there. They're available to us. We know what to do. The thing that we don't have is that sort of public push from the bottom, a movement that says, we know that something is wrong with our economy. We know that this is not the way that we think things are supposed to go, and we want to see change. And so writing this book, I really wanted to get out into the world and talk to people about how these monopolies affect their daily life. And in doing that, I learned that people have an innate sense that something is very wrong, that as consumers, as workers, as citizens, as entrepreneurs, as small businesses, that they understand that something's wrong, that these companies have too much power over their lives. And it's a matter of building a movement that brings those people and their concerns together and forces the political system to act. And this can be done because this is how we got those laws in the first place.
Right.
The progressive era, that is what happened. The farmers, laborers, small business owners, they came together and said, this doesn't work. The railroads are taking all of our profits away. The steel trust and the beef trust, and they're harming our workers and harming and making products that malfunction and are dangerous. We need to do something about this. And the political system eventually got the message and they did something about it. So that's what needs to happen again.
David, thank you so much for all the work you do and for spending this time with us. Good luck with the book.
Thank you very much, Nally. Thanks for your interest.
My guest is David Dayan, a frequent guest on our program. He's the executive editor of the American Prospect. We've been discussing his latest book, Monopolized: Life in the Age of Corporate Power. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.